Today on Straight Talk Africa, what is the meaning of democracy? Is it a Western or a Euro-American concept with no practical value for Africa? Or is it a universal value? That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Salih, and today we are discussing whether democracy is a Western concept with no practical value for Africa, or whether it has a universal value. Democratic governance and leadership on the African continent continue to be the leading priorities for sub-Saharan Africa in 2019, according to a study published by the Brookings Institution's Africa Growth Initiative. But does a liberal Western-style democracy work for Africa? My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
The Africa Foresight 2019 study conducted by the Brookings Institution, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization devoted to independent research and policy solutions, says that governance and leadership should be the priority for Africa in 2019. Brahima Kruble, a senior fellow at the Brookings, explains.
Democracy is consolidating, although the prevalence of tensions and in some countries violence suggests that there are areas for improvement. And the demographic tidal wave looms closer, but job creation has not been able to keep up. And despite continued progress on governance, more efforts are needed to eradicate corruption, and very importantly, to elevate the voice and representation of young people and women in decision-making.
Building governance and democratic institutions remains an uphill battle for most African nations. Western-style democracy is being tested across the continent, especially in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. For example, in Uganda, incumbent President Yoweri Museveni has exploited ambiguities in the law to extend his term in office as head of state, while simultaneously undermining the nation's constitution. Earlier this month, the British Parliament held a historic debate on the state of democracy in Uganda.
Serious concerns have been raised internationally about the Ugandan government systematically undermining democracy in their country.
Vanda Felabab Brown, a senior fellow on a foreign policy at Brookings, says that in some countries, the essence of democracy is solely about elections, appearing to undermine the broader meaning of democracy, which is accountability.
Democracy, in my view, should also be about human rights, civil liberties, and other mechanisms of accountability than simply elections. These other mechanisms of accountability having to do with how the government on a day-to-day basis is held accountable to the laws of the country.
Abebe Amero Selassie, director of the Africa Department at the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, says another critical area undermining democracy in Africa is corruption.
Lack of transparency often how transactions take place, the weakness of institutions, and importantly also the impunity, as she calls it, or lack of accountability when corrupt incidents are found. So particularly the transparency side is something which we work on a great deal, and I think that's one of the ways in which we can help.
Linda Thomas Greenfield, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, now a senior counselor at the Albright Stonebridge Group, says leadership is essential for Africa's economic development.
I can't stress enough the transformative effects of good leadership that is focused on delivering for the common man and doing what is right, irrespective of the political cost. And we're seeing some changes take place on the continent of Africa. We're seeing new leaders begin to step up to the forefront that we hadn't even thought of before. And Ethiopia comes to mind for me, and even what I see happening in Angola now.
Perhaps upcoming elections in Nigeria and South Africa offer a ray of hope to strengthen democracy and governance in two of Africa's biggest economies. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us in the studio are two distinguished guests. Azaz Elshami, a Sudanese-American human rights advocate, and Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, a professor of law, Pretoria University in South Africa, and a former Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University in the United Kingdom. And joining us from London is Prince Dickson Wasaja, an international lawyer based in Britain, Dr. Paul Williams, a Labour Party Member of Parliament of the United Kingdom, was scheduled to join us but had to decline due to another commitment regarding the Brexit debate. Well, I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
You're most welcome, Shaka.
Thanks for having us.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you immediately, Prince Wasaja. Good evening.
Good evening, Ndugu Shaka, and good evening to all the viewers of Straight Talk Africa.
How are you?
I'm terrific and exceedingly honored to be on Straight Talk Africa this evening. And Happy New Year to you and all the viewers.
You too, except that the audience must be very disappointed, especially because they did expect to hear from Dr. Paul Williams.
Yes, that's correct. And I would like to unreservedly convey Dr. Paul Williams' apology for those that are following events that are unfolding in British politics. A major event that is taking place now is the UK's decision to depart from its membership of the European Union. So it's a very hot issue that is hotly debated on the floor of the British Parliament, and Dr. Paul Williams is a leading member of those that are saying the UK should instead forget about the decision of the referendum and stay in the European Union. So he is very, very sorry to all the viewers and listeners out there. But next time, when an opportunity arises, he will feature on this show.
Thank you very much for the explanation. And of course, we do accept the apologies. And we hope that in the not far distant future, we'll be having him on this show, and he'll be able to address that particular issue with our audience. Now, let me come to you immediately, Prince Wasaja. First of all, this obviously would have been a question for the British Member of Parliament, but you are also the force, perhaps, behind that particular debate. Why was that particular issue regarding the democracy in Uganda, why did it become a subject for the British Parliament?
Yeah, thank you, Shaka. Now, for those that have been following the politics of Uganda for the past now 33 years, this Saturday, when dictator Museveni is ruling over the people of Uganda. When Museveni first came in office, the British and Americans declared him as one of the new breed of African leaders. He belonged to that unique group whereby Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia, later when Kagame of Rwanda came in, they represented in the view of the British and generally the Western countries, a new breed of leaders that inspire hope, the hope of leading African countries to a democratic path. You remember when Mr. Museveni first addressed Ugandans, the first words he used, which have stayed in the memory of so many Ugandans and historians, is castigating leaders that overstay, leaders that steal elections, leaders that brutalize their opponents, not knowing to those that were listening to him that this is a man that doesn't mean his word, he is a pathological liar, he turned against whatever he stood for, and he turned against his opponents, he banned political parties from practicing their activities in the country. He organized one sham election after the other. He has brutalized his opponents. He has presided over the most corrupt regime in the history of Uganda. So all the tenets of democracy, this man, Dictator Museveni, just turned against everything. So with that catalogue of lies and failures of his government, he disappointed not just Ugandans, but his backers in the West. The West, I'm referring to countries like Britain, where I am today, the US, and many countries that have really come out strongly to condemn his dictatorial excesses. Now, Britain has got a moral duty to not only the people of Uganda, but the people of the United Kingdom. Britain is the leading donor to financing the Ugandan budget. Uganda is an extremely poor country that depends on a big part on aid to finance its operations. And Britain, for example, this financial year has injected 500 billion Uganda shillings to support the people of Uganda. So Britain has got a big stake in Uganda. Democracy is a universal principle that we all share as humans. It's not just for the white man that a black man shouldn't be concerned about democracy. So Britain, as a key stakeholder in Uganda, has got every right to say to Dictator Museveni that you are brutalizing your people, you are torturing Ugandans, the aid that we're extending to your country, there is no accountability. You are just siphoning, you are just stealing money that is meant to assist the people of Uganda. So we applaud, we are extremely grateful for the step that the British Parliament, under the leadership of Dr. Paul Williams, took to debate the catastrophic state of democracy in Uganda, which is really a very, very big concern for every humanity, for all humanity. All humans, wherever they are, should be concerned about injustices, wherever they are, in any place, anywhere in the world.
How do you respond to some people who say that this is perhaps a little bit too late in the game, really, especially when you talk about Britain having a moral obligation, and yet Britain, the last time I checked, has actually supported Yoweri Museveni's, what you call Yoweri Museveni's dictatorship, for more than 30 years. It wrongly identified Yoweri Museveni with his colleagues as the beacons of hope for African democracy. That was back in 1990s. Nothing has happened from Addis Ababa to Kampala. And you also know, as well as I do, that Britain was the colonial master of the Uganda Protectorate for more than 60 years. Britain so far has not really been able to exercise its basically moral values, really. Its Western values of democracy, rule of law, freedom of expression, and what have you. it seems to me that it has actually chosen instead to exercise what they call vital national security interests at the expense of their values. How do you respond to that?
Yes, that's a very important point that you are raising, Shaka, because it takes us back to this man, Museveni. Despot Museveni is a very manipulative person. He has lied to everybody. He has been feeding his backers on lies, on empty lies. That hasn't just been done on the West, all those that have been backing him for all these years, but even those that have been closest to him. For example, the former Prime Minister, Amama Mbabazi, who thought that by this time Museveni would be gone and Uganda would be having a new leader. That wasn't the case. Take the example of your friend, Dr. Kizza Besigye, who has challenged Museveni for a number of times now and has won elections against Museveni, and Museveni has refused to hand over power and stayed in office by the use of the army, with the support of the army. Now, the late intervention of Britain is a factor that we cannot, as Ugandans, just leave to Britain to take the blame. We needed, as Ugandans, to take a lead in pressuring this monstrous dictator to hand over power. Now that the West is starting to listen to the cries, to the voices of Ugandans, that this man has been a liar through and through, the catalogue of events that demonstrate the brutal nature of his regime, that evidence is there for everybody to see. The war in northern Uganda, where over a million people lost their lives, and no single accountability has been shown by the Ugandan regime about the atrocities that were committed by the Ugandan army. The invasion of Congo, where the International Court of Justice found Uganda culpable for plundering Congo's natural resources, and Uganda was asked to pay now what is in the excess of $10 billion compensation for the looting that Museveni and his cronies conducted in the neighboring Congo. Go to Rwanda. The support that he gave to Kagame and and his group to go and overthrow Habyarimana's government, the people that died there. All this evidence has come back to haunt Museveni. The main atrocities, his opponents that he has been killing day in, day out, all that is there to see that this man is a liability to the West. He's no longer an asset, and the late intervention, late as it may be, it's a welcome intervention, and we applaud those that are intervening to support the people of Uganda to get rid of this brutal dictator, Museveni.
Thank you very much. Let me come to you, Azaz. To what extent do you sincerely think that the British have a moral obligation for Ugandans to enjoy the concept of democracy? Isn't it really up to the Ugandans themselves?
Yes, that's true. I cannot speak for the Ugandan context, but I will talk about the colonialism in general. Most of the maladies that we see in Africa is a result of that, and of this hasty decolonization, hand-me-down government system and governance system that they've given to us, and also being in cahoot with most of these dictators over the years through benefiting from extractive economy in Africa. And I don't think it's only the UK that it has a moral obligation. I think the whole international community has an obligation, not only to Ugandan specifically, but I'm talking about the continent in general, because it's been expulsed, it's been used as a backdoor and a backyard for their economy, and every time they present themselves as savior, but it's actually they are helping themselves, not the people of the country. Yes, on the part of the African citizen, yes, this is something they own, and this is something that belongs to them, and they have the agency to do, but it's quite hard when you have all the odds against you.
But when you think about the fact that the British were the colonial masters of many countries, including Uganda, and that colonialism by implication really means certainly not democracy, it probably means a sort of dictatorship. Mm-hmm. It wanted Uganda for resources. Do you sincerely think that the British at the end of the day care very much whether or not Ugandans enjoy democracy for as long as they have unfettered access to resources?
Well, the world dynamics are different now, and the way that powers or international community interferes with different countries is not necessarily based on moral obligation, as much as it's like self-interest as well. The way the world is forming now, insecurity in one place, it is implicating and making insecurities in the UK. So even if they don't care directly about the democracy as a principle, to them to have a democratic, thriving, better economy in Africa makes the UK safer. And also, as your guest said, they have their own penny into this. So to them, it matters that the money doesn't go to corrupt governments that keeps asking for it. The world is changing now. It's not going to be able to have this welfare system anymore. You know what I mean? It's not going to be sustainable. And the UK of the colonization era is not the UK now. The UK now, or the government, or the system in there, it's more diverse and is not necessarily the same English canon at the time.
Dr. Mwenda.
Thank you so much, Chaka.
Yes. A former great British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, he once said that democracy was the worst form of government except for the others. What did he exactly mean by that?
In most, let me not even say most, in some cases you can have a situation where there's a dictatorship of some oligarchs, aristocrats, or elitists, for example, when you have representational democracy without effective checks and balances like separation of powers. They can actually manipulate the system because they dominate parliament. They'll pass laws in their favors. They are good friends with the judges. They appoint each other. So those sorts of things. It may be a democracy on paper, but the checks and balances, like the rule of law, they're not in place. So you have to look at issues from a very broader systemic point of view. That's where the danger of democracy sometimes comes in.
Now, Prince Wasaja.
Yes, Shaka.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear.
You know, as Dr. Mwenda said, when you in fact look on paper, you will find that Uganda is probably fit to be characterized as a democratic society. It has the three organs of government. You are talking about the judiciary system, and it's supposed to be independent. You are talking about the National Assembly. The two are supposed to be bringing about the element of checks and balances in as far as the executive is concerned. What happens in practice in Uganda, for example, from the evidence that you have?
From the evidence that is there for anyone who follows events in Uganda to see, is that Museveni made himself a god of some sort. He considers himself as the god of Uganda. He knows everything. He cannot be advised. Everybody around him is a fool. All Ugandans are fools. In fact, he goes around making speeches. This is in the open, calling opposition leaders fools, swines, referring to them as pigs. That's the language that Museveni uses. So coming to the institutions of the state that are sacrosanct as far as having a democratic society is concerned, take the example of parliament. The Ugandan parliament is a useless organ of the state. It is packed by Museveni's cronies. One time, despot Museveni made a speech, a very infamous speech, where he mentioned that he would prefer the people of Uganda to vote for members of parliament that will go to parliament and sleep and only be woken up to vote for whatever he likes when that moment arrives, than robust, intelligent, awake members of parliament that would go there and challenge his government and hold his government to account, accountable on behalf of their electorates, on behalf of their constituencies. So this is the kind of leader you are having. Now come to the judiciary. When you go to the judiciary, he despises the judges. In fact, everybody knows that he has been packing the judiciary with so-called cadres, the National Resistance Movement cadres, people that would just rule, make rulings that favor him, regardless of following due process of the law. Come to his executive. He is the only one. No minister in Museveni's government has got any powers. It is him. If a border rider, a motorcyclist on the street has got an issue, that issue, that person knows that will not be resolved unless it has caught the attention of Mr. Museveni. Take the example of the recent chaos in the Ugandan parliament, where members of parliament, after taking bribes in broad daylight, removed the presidential term limits. They lined up to take bribes. Recently, when they changed the constitution to remove the age limit that would have prevented Dictator Museveni from standing again in 2021, they openly took bribes. These are thugs masquerading as members of parliament. It's a national disgrace. What is going on in Uganda is a disgrace to humanity, not just to the people of Uganda. It's shocking, but that's the reality. And that's what Museveni has reduced Uganda to. The country is broken. All institutions of the state are dead, completely dead and buried. Any leader who comes in after Museveni has got a huge challenge. Their work is cut out to rebuild that country from zero.
Kenneth, Prince Wasajja seems to portray Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni as the all-powerful, as someone that can get his way the way he wants, and yet he only happens to be one out of 40 million people. I remember many years ago interviewing the first sub-Saharan African UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and we talked about the issue of oppression and what have you. And I remember him saying, you know, Shaka, no one can oppress you unless you grant him or her your consent. What does it need to take, really, in order for people in positions of authority, like a Speaker of the National Assembly of Uganda, a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Uganda, to actually do their job Why is it that not only in Uganda, in fact, in a lot of African countries, that the National Assembly or Parliament and the judicial systems are subordinate to the executive, which happens to be headed by a president?
Good question, Shaka. Last time I was in Uganda, actually, I flew to Entebbe. I was flying from Frankfurt, first class, with Lufthansa. I was with the First Lady, Janet Museveni. And we met for the first time on the plane. We had a good conversation. I was going there for other things, for work. So I have fond memories of my visit to Uganda, lovely country. The issue of what we call excesses, state arbitrary excesses, often ties in with the concept of constitutionalism and the rule of law. What do we mean by constitutionalism? Constitutionalism is the understanding that all actors, private actors, state actors, must act within the limits of the law. But that can only happen in situations where, for example, you have effective institutions that can hold the state back from encroaching on the rights and liberties of individuals and the public at large. Now, Uganda is not unique in that respect. We have seen some of these atrocities committed by governments in Latin America, governments in Asia, and other parts of Africa as well. But we do empathize with the position that is currently obtaining in Uganda. But by and large, it's how we build these institutions, and also when you look at the constitutions, how we draft and develop our constitutions. For example, there's no need for a head of state to be appointing a judge. You have that model in the United States of America, quite okay. But that doesn't mean it's the right way to go in Africa. You can adapt concepts, for example, especially where you have a very all-powerful president. In the U.S., there are checks and balances, you know, that are quite effective. They can hold back the president. But in Africa, this guy, we have a, mind you, Uganda is a presidential system of government, like the U.S. We have other models like the Westminster model, the parliamentary system of government, where the prime minister is the head of government. But in a presidential system of government, for the most part, in Africa, we have seen that. The president can be an all-powerful guy. So it's how you restrain him and the executive from encroaching on the liberties of individuals as well as the judiciary and the legislature that is very important in the way you draft your constitutions.
Would it be fair to say, Kenneth, that in a country like Uganda and indeed several other countries on the African continent, we do not have citizens, we have subjects? Citizens meaning owing allegiance to the state and therefore having constitutional rights, inalienable rights, in fact, birthrights. Right. Whereas subjects, you do not owe allegiance to the state because you owe it to an individual authority. And you do not have any constitutional rights or birthrights because you are only granted privileges by the individual authority that you owe allegiance to.
Yeah, the concept that you're sort of articulating, Shaka, comes from what is known as the Magna Carta in the history of human rights in the United Kingdom. In 1215, King John in England signed with some barons who had helped him in return for pieces of land. He signed the Great Charter, known as the Magna Carta. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the Magna Carta, and I think, if I remember pretty well, it's Article 39 of the Magna Carta. It guaranteed protection to these barons for the state, or rather the king, not to take away arbitrarily their life, their property, and their liberties, three things. So the Magna Carta is antecedent to the U.S. Constitution, for example, and the Bill of Rights, and many other common law jurisdictions. Uganda is a common law jurisdiction. So we borrow a lot of traditions from the English in the way we've crafted our constitutions, especially the Bill of Rights. Now, it's I think it's important also to be mindful that every situation, every jurisdiction has some peculiarities which are specific to the context. The way, for example, Yoweri Museveni came to power, he was a revolutionary and so forth. And how does he transition to a civic individual? Now, to say that the Ugandan people are not citizens, I think I have difficulties with that. They are citizens. Mm. I cannot reduce them to subjects. They are citizens. However,
citizens who behave as or like subjects.
I wouldn't say so, because that's a sweeping statement. There should be, I believe, amongst Ugandans, some Ugandans who have a conscience, political conscience, to actually do things right. They just need the space to be given that opportunity. So I would be a bit hesitant to
cut it. And where would they get that space from? Is there any specific individual who is supposed to grant that space to them, or are they in fact supposed to demand it?
Yeah, good question. You know, again, it will take a while before we see some of these changes coming into place. Where you have an authoritarian system of government, of course, it's quite risky for individuals to step forward. But you have some matters. For example, our colleague across there is a Ugandan lawyer and is articulated issue. He is from Uganda, and there are other Ugandans like him. I've got personal friends of mine in Uganda who are lawyers.
Well, I'm sure that the Chief Justice of Uganda is a Ugandan himself.
Indeed. But neither can we question his credibility, because we don't have empirical evidence on that.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback on Facebook and Twitter. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, has the perception of women as leaders on the continent changed in the last decade? Are women still facing more difficult challenges to attain leadership roles? An in-depth discussion on African women and their future as leaders on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing the meaning of democracy. Is it a universal value? Our guests are Azaz Erushami, a Sudanese-American human rights advocate, and Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, professor of law at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. Well, I have to say, lady and gentlemen, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
You're welcome, sir.
Let me ask you a very simple question now. You know, they've been saying that democracy does not belong to Africa. It is Muzungu, Mulungu democracy. It belongs to the European, to the Americans, and what have you. But what about the fundamental tenets of democracy? How come to me they seem to be universal, Azaz? Talk about accountability, for example.
Yes. So this is quite interesting, because I feel like a lot of people or voices in Africa, especially when they say there is no democracy in Africa, they cannot overlook that we did have governance in Africa before we were invaded or colonized or encountered with the Western civilization. And yes, we had our share of wars, but there was day-to-day governance system through chiefdom, through tribal elder, council of elders, and others. And as you said, at the end of it, it might not be called democracy, but accountability, having justice, and sometimes justice can be contextual.
Fairness,
having a place to litigate.
Freedom of expression.
Exactly, to have a place where you can voice your grievances, a venue for you to be heard. I come from a village in northern Sudan, and those systems were there. They were applicable. The way that the leadership presumes or comes to power, it might not be through electoral means, but it, nevertheless, they do serve what people would need of them. And also, they do have the feedback. The issue happens when you started to have two clashes, the clash between the two civilizations. What the colonizers wanted to see in these state that they colonized, and the existing system. And what happened, it just happened like an update or migration of system without having enough time for it to be organic and to be actually compatible with what we have. Everything I see around me in Africa, it's a hand-me-down. Everything is just like cosmetic, only on the surface, without digging deeper and taking more of the values. Like, for instance, elections are completely void. Nobody, if you talk to African, average citizen in Africa and tell them about election, to them it's a void. Because actually what it's become associated with is consolidation of power, is violence, is the same faces winning over and over again through rigged elections.
It is, in fact, about what some call state capture.
Exactly.
So that you control the state, which in turn gives you an opportunity, for example, to control the economy, the resources.
Exactly.
What about that, Kenneth?
Great question. Whether democracy is a Western concept and not suited for Africa? Excellent question. A simple answer to that.
But is fairness really a monopoly, a preserve of the West?
Not at all.
What about justice?
Yeah, not at all.
Accountability.
And let me explain.
Those things, in fact, obtain in Kavale, where I was born and grew
indeed,
up.
Indeed.
The problem actually comes when you are talking about the state.
Yes.
And who controls it.
Right. Now, if you look at, for example, Aristotle wrote that, you know, you're better off with a government of laws than a government of men. These are great Greek philosophers way back. Now, if you look at the African concept, as my sister's well articulated here, we've had this concept. I think the challenge that we have is the sort of dichotomy between the concept of private rights in Western jurisprudence and legal thinking and communal rights, on the other hand, and moral obligations in African, Asia, and Latin America sort of context. So whereas, for example, in Africa, there's a lot of emphasis on moral responsibilities and obligations in our legal thinking, jurisprudence, and African customary law, for example. In the West, the concept which derives many from Magna Carta is about entitlements. I'm an individual. I'm entitled to this. We don't have much of that concept.
Land
and even Western
titles.
Thinking.
Land titles.
Exactly. Western thinking intellectuals from the West sometimes struggle with these concepts.
And yet, you know, for the most part, when you look at Africa, we're talking about extended relationships.
Correct.
So if that is true, any particular reason, for example, why would not borrow very heavily from the Scandinavian examples? Because you're talking about the Scandinavian examples where you're talking about Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and what have you. You're talking about societies sincerely that practice something very close to social, economic, political justice for all.
There have been a lot of contributions from pundits and various scholars, African scholars, leftists especially, who've argued that economic determinism, economic democracy, so to speak, should precede political democracy. That you can only talk of human rights in a context where wealth is there and freely shared across. And now that's sort of a leftist Marxist approach. But also there's another school of thought which talks about generation of human rights. The first generation, which is, you know, what you see in the Bill of Rights, and the second generation, socioeconomic rights, political rights, and so forth. Where you give primacy, you know, where do you give primacy between the two of those? I think that there's a lot of thinking that's going into that. But what Africa, I think, needs to learn is that democracy is a universal concept. It's not peculiar or unique to the Western world. It's a universal concept. However,
how you implement democracy and the institutions you use to implement democracy may differ across the board.
How you practice it.
Exactly.
How you tweak it.
Exactly. Because you have to adapt it.
Because when you think about the Scandinavian countries, really, right, when you think about their practice, it seems to me, frankly, that it's more or less like a reflection of what African culture actually does.
Right.
You're talking about, again, extended relationships here.
Yeah. But what you don't have in the Nordic countries is extractive economy. It's completely different for an African citizen who sells cocoa and then buys it triple or quadruple price of mm-hmm. what he did it for. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's completely different because in Africa, it's been subject to systematic looting on an international level.
Well, they raise pigs in Denmark. They raised pigs.
No, but I mean, where they at now, they're not victim to expulsive and extractive economy that had gone for almost a century.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's like where we start now.
Look at Norway, for example. Norway produces oil. The last time I checked, it's probably one of the few oil-producing countries that in fact does not even touch the monies that come out of oil. They keep it for the next generation. Whereas Africa has several countries that produce oil, and that kind of oil, to some people, seems to have been a curse.
Yeah, Shaggy, you know, I think on that also, one aspect of democracy which we cannot ignore, especially for developing countries in Africa in particular, is the good governance.
Mm-hmm.
We have to tie democracy to good governance when it comes to accountability, for example.
Right.
Financial management systems, issue of corruption, integrity risks, and so forth.
Mm.
In a lot of our projects and development agendas that we have on the continent, we have seen, for example, the issue of state captures, you've rightly pointed out. Some executives, members of the executive, have benefited out of this unfairly. And I think what will help Africa in particular is to try and have more robust and sound systems of governance and tie this to democracy.
Mm.
Democracy does not, it's like law. Law does not exist in the abstract.
In a vacuum.
In a vacuum. You know, you can have all the brilliant laws out there, but right, as long as they're not implementable or they're poorly implemented, you're paying lip service to them, there's nothing that you're doing. The Constitution has to be written in the heart of human beings.
But can that happen when you do not have people, frankly, who have reached a point where they understand they are socially and politically conscious of their rights?
Good question. In fact, what is happening now in a lot of research that is coming up, one of the tenets of democracy is actually education. You cannot afford to ignore education because an enlightened electorate, for example, end up making wrong choices.
Right.
So it's very important that education, in fact, education is a human right.
Yes, it should be a human right.
It's a human right.
Right.
You know, so
just like healthcare should be
exactly,
a human right.
You know, so there are a lot of these arguments that are coming through now that education is a human right. It's a part of the tenet of democracy. If you ignore education, you end up with a situation where you have cadres, political cadres chanting songs and supporting a dictator. But, you know, again, it comes back to philosophy of the Greek thinkers back then, like Aristotle, for example, who questioned. He said, look, we have to subject our leaders to, you know, the law and across the board. It doesn't matter whether these are institutions, these are powerful individuals. Nobody's above the law. That is the philosophy also that you find in the Magna Carta. You're all subject to decisions of other human beings who are like judges, for example, and the law. You're, no one is above the law.
I have to apologize, by the way, Kenneth, that our colleague Azaz Elshami is not feeling well.
And therefore, she
has left for...
We'll do our best to chip
in. I hope that she feels much better.
Yeah,
but you talk about education. Of course, it's very, very important that society gets educated. But perhaps even more importantly, we should also be talking about civic education.
Correct.
We're not talking about PhDs here.
No, correct.
Civic education.
You're absolutely right.
So that people, in fact, know what their rights are. Know that, in fact, in a democracy, They are the masters. They are the bosses. They are the main stakeholders. They are the primary stakeholders, right, who employ people called presidents, right, people called chief justices, ambassadors, and cabinet ministers, and all that kind of stuff.
You're absolutely right, Shaka. There are some conflicts of traditions in different legal systems, Western thinking, for example, and what you find in Africa. I'll give you an example. I know this is a very sensitive topic, but I'm just using it as an illustration. The Africans, for example, have shown some resistance against things like LGBT rights.
Yes.
At the same time, they are saying, look, if we are going to recognize LGBT rights, we might as well recognize polygamy, because that's an African concept, which is not accepted in much of Western legal thinking. It's monogamy.
But I think that in Africa, it is accepted.
In Western legal thinking,
it's not. Under traditional custom law and what have you.
Good point, but I'll tell you something about much of Commonwealth Africa. Almost all common English-speaking common law jurisdictions have put polygamous marriages as secondary under African customary law. Once there is a statutory marriage, it's monogamous. If you go against that, it becomes polygamy. It's a criminal offense. So you can only have a polygamous marriage if you have not contracted a statutory marriage, which follows thinking under English law.
What about South Africa?
Same thing. You either have a polygamy or a monogamous statutory marriage. You can't have both. That's polygamy. You run the risk of violating the criminal laws for the offense of bigamy. You can be arrested for that.
Kenneth, I was wondering, for example, there is a man called Thomas Edison.
Yes.
He is sometimes credited for having invented the electric bulb, even though there are a lot of literature disputing that in fact he may not have actually invented the electric bulb, but that he probably may have succeeded in launching the electric bulb to be a commercially feasible product, to the extent that I have not heard anybody complaining about where electricity comes from. But I have heard people complain about this thing called democracy. And yet, democracy is supposed to be an infrastructure, mm-hmm, to lay a foundation for society in order for it to move forward. How come the African elite, for example, do not have problems enjoying electricity, do not have problems, for example, enjoying the telephone, an invention of Alexander Graham Bell.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I did undergraduate studies in upstate New York, and that is where he apparently used to live, and he was buried there. I have not heard anybody complaining about the telephone, mm-hmm, but I have heard people complaining about democracy.
I think where we seem to be getting this wrong as a people, as African people, we have abandoned or neglected much of the thinking that started off from the olden days of anti-colonialism. There was a lot of good thinking by people like Almica Cabral, people like Franz Fanon.
Return to the roots.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We need to revisit history.
Yes.
To understand where we are coming from.
Yes.
Because much of what you're seeing, the political elites on the African continent, for the most part, these are petty bourgeois.
They buy Mercedes-Benz, for example, which comes from Germany.
Exactly.
They don't see any contradictions.
Yeah. And then you have these real sort of the bourgeois class in the Western countries, these multinationals, who have an interest in Africa, extractive industries, for example, mining industry, for example. Now you have also the Chinese coming in. But you have these middlemen in Africa who are politicians who get corrupt, cuts and stuff like that. So I think we need to revisit much of where we are coming from. A lot of these things have been thought through by our forefathers. We're just neglecting the literature and trying to jump around in a haphazard, ad hoc manner. But a lot of thinking has been done in the past. If you look at what people like Samir Amin wrote, especially is thinking about metropole satellite, they may appear to be old ideas.
The man that they
but, you know, if you get back to that literature, you begin to see things in context and where we are as a continent
used
today.
Used to be, you know, a man who propounded the idea of dependencia theory.
Exactly. Yeah, he just passed on, I think, 2 years ago.
That's right. Yes. He was a great Egyptian, yeah, exactly. A great African. Yeah. Academic.
So what I would really say is, you know, before we sort of try to come up with new ideas, let's take stock of where we are coming from.
What we have.
What we have already.
And how we can best utilize it.
Exactly.
For the benefit of our people.
Of our people. There's a lot of some of these labels and concepts that are coming up. Yeah, they're just repackaged. It's the same old wine in new bottles. Today you call it globalization. Tomorrow you can call it something else. Today you call it corruption. In another country, it's called networking. These are repackaged concepts, but we all know what it's all about.
Very interesting. When I was growing up, and it is very, very many years ago, I used to hear people spoke about how Africa produces what it does not consume, and consuming what it does not produce. I have later heard African leaders, or some of them, talking about adding value. But how many times can you talk the talk of adding value without, in fact, walking that talk so that your people can indeed walk the walk, and yet you have been in the office for 30 years?
It's unfortunate. Yes, especially the raw materials, you know, export of raw materials. We are excited about export promotion, you know, copper, how much copper, you know, receipts we are getting from export of copper and so forth. But much of the finished products, when those products are exported abroad, you're absolutely right, they are consumed in Africa. For example, copper is used to manufacture bullets. So where there's war, for example, if there's war in Congo, the same copper that left Zambia will go abroad, and Western countries will make bullets and export them to the Congo.
Come back, in a form that, in fact, helps them die.
Exactly. You know, and
cobalt, of course, is used, for example, in the manufacture of batteries and all that kind
of
stuff.
Exactly. And we'll pay three times more, you know, what it costs to export, you know, those raw materials.
Coltan, of course, its wonders with regards to iPhones,
right.
Laptops. Yeah. And what have you?
And in a lot of these countries, what you find, take Zambia, for example, you know, for years and years, we've been talking about diversifying the economy from a monocultural copper economy. But, you know, a little bit of agriculture is taking place, but there hasn't been a concerted effort to diversify the economy. And so when you're trapped in this situation where you're relying heavily on copper as your main export, this is exactly what happens. And if the copper prices are down, you know, the guys who are buying, they obviously buy them cheap, and, you know, you lose out. Now you have a lot of, I don't want to mention nationalities, but, you know, a lot of private investors who bought mines in a very controversial manner in a country like Zambia. Some of them have recovered the amount they put in to buy those mines. They recovered within a year the purchase price for the mines. Then you begin to ask yourself, what went wrong here? We had infrastructure. The infrastructure has been stripped by some of these shoddy investors. What went wrong here? Where are the proceeds of privatization? We don't know.
If you were to talk to African leaders, if some of them are watching a program like this, what would you say to them that they probably need to do in order to make a big difference, really, for the benefit of their people?
Number one, do not and never surround yourself with cronies. Very bad decision for any leader. They'll be cheering you on even when you're running into a ditch. That's very, very important. That's a critical mistake that a lot of African leaders make. They like men who salute them.
I see. Well, I'm told that time happens not to be our best ally. And on that note, Azaz Erishami, Dr. Kenneth Mwenda, and Dr. Paul Williams did not show up because of Brexit. And of course, last but not least, Prince Dickson Wasaja was with us earlier. Also, thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.